Drugs are buying, okay? Don't do drugs. Drugs are buying, okay?
Hello, beautiful humans. I'm Tymie Castle.
And I'm Benjamin Mead.
And you're listening to Just a Minute. Just a Minute is an educational podcast where we break down justice topics in 30 minutes or less. Today's topic, problem-solving courts. Hello, and thanks for joining us. Hello, Ben.
Well, hey. I got a quick question for you. Do you remember that movie, The Mighty Ducks?
Yes.
It was a Disney movie.
I don't remember the plot or anything, but I sort of recall the movie.
Emilio Estevez.
Yes.
It's actually pretty funny to think it's a kid's movie because he gets busted for drunk driving. Okay. And then his community services, he has to coach a kid's hockey team. And they're kind of like a group of like losers, kind of like the Bad News Bears,
Misfits.
But on ice.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But anyway, in the film, if you remember or not.
I don't.
Like there was a goalie, the kid who played the goalie, he's an actor named Sean Weiss.
Oh,
and there's actually a pretty funny scene where they're trying to train him and they tie him to the goal. He's like taped to his arms and legs spread and they all just like start shooting pucks at him and he's making wisecracks and stuff. But anyway, as many child actors tend to do, he ended up addicted to drugs.
Oh, no.
Bad.
Oh,
yeah, he was
heroin.
Yeah, and meth.
And meth. Okay.
Yeah, so in 2020, he was arrested for burglary. He was like in somebody's garage and he broke into their car. And I think he was just like sleeping in the car.
Yeah.
You can look his mugshot up and it's
bad.
It's awful. Yeah. It's bad. And I mean, in the movies, he was kind of like the 90s kids trope, the heavy kid, heavy kid. And I mean, it's just
sad.
Yeah. It's crazy. But the good news is he went to drug court.
Oh, nice.
And,
okay.
Yeah, in 2021, he successfully completed drug court.
Okay.
And I did some research, and apparently he's still sober, and he's doing stand-up comedy. So it seems
Wonderful.
Like drug court was a success.
Yay.
For him. And drug courts are an example of the broader phenomenon that we're going to talk about today, problem-solving courts.
Right.
And as I was thinking about talking about this, I was going to say like, well, like for a change, we're going to do like a good thing because usually we kind of like poo-poo everything. I remember you said on the Christmas episode, we ruin everything.
We ruin everything.
But our porn episode just came out.
It did.
The age restrictions for porn use.
When you say it like that, our porn episode just came out.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds a lot better than just like age restriction. But anyway,
our
age restriction on porn use came out. And I was thinking about that was another good topic we did. And we didn't call attention to it at the time. But, as justice studies, we tend to focus on like injustice and the bad things. But age restrictions for porn.
Yes.
For kids is a good thing.
Yeah, and given the deleterious effects that we talked about on children.
Yeah. In drug courts seem to be, we'll talk a little bit more, there's a little less knowledge on, kind of the broader problem solving course, but there's a lot of studies that show that drug courts can be successful.
Great. Let's get into it.
Right. And the last thing I want to mention is this is another request from Isabel Foley.
Oh, so right.
We mentioned, mentioned her before, former student. So shout out to Isabel.
Shout out. And thanks for the topic suggestion.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, tell us about the courts.
All right, so problem-solving courts are specialized criminal courts that offer enhanced supervision and treatment instead of incarceration. And these can be kind of for like specific offenses or specific types of offenders. So there's all kinds of different problem-solving courts, including drug courts, which we mentioned before, DUI courts, domestic violence courts, mental health courts, veterans courts, reentry courts, and probably some
lots of courts
that I'm missing. Yeah,
right.
So kind of like a court to specialize on a specific offense or offender. And the commonality is that the court is trying to address factors that without some kind of intervention, non-punitive approach would result in repeated interaction with the criminal legal system.
Right.
So essentially the spark behind the creation of these courts was the observation that individuals weren't getting their problems fixed by the criminal legal system.
Imagine that.
The law, get tough legislation, mandatory minimums and kind of like the breakdown of other institutions like the mental health deinstitutionalization. had basically criminalized statuses like mental health or homelessness or drug addiction. And, you know, all of these kind of combined things created a situation where we were putting people in prison for things that, you know, are kind of like problems associated with crime, you know, that are criminogenic. So problem-solving courts try to address those underlying problems and not punish people and send them to prison for them.
Right.
And the idea became popular. Problem-solving courts spread quickly. The first problem-solving court was created over 30 years ago. It was a drug court. We're going to come back and talk more about drug courts in a bit later. Drug courts are, you know, very well known, widely researched, so we'll talk a lot about that. But, you know, more broadly, based on a 2021 report, there were over 4,000 problem-solving courts across the country.
Okay, so how do they work?
So typically, defendants submit to intensive treatment screenings overseen by a probation officer. They regularly appear before a judge before for check-ins, and then if they successfully complete the drug court, usually that results in like a reduction of sentence or a dismissal of charges. So in the case of the Mighty Ducks goalie, his burglary charge was dismissed. So he successfully completed drug court, burglary charge dismissed.
Okay.
And there are a number of important, you know, features or characteristics of problem-solving courts. Obviously, the most important one, as we've kind of already hinted, is that they integrate treatment with the criminal justice process.
Right.
Also, an important aspect of problem-solving courts is that it involves kind of non-traditional roles of the court actors in system change. I think in our plea bargaining episode, we talked about the adversarial system and that, you know, like attorneys are supposed to be like combatants fighting against each other. But the idea in problem-solving courts is it's not supposed to be adversarial. Everybody's kind of supposed to be working together in more of like a case management approach.
Yeah.
And that includes the judges. Judges are much more hands-on compared to a typical case and are kind of like the overseers or administrators of the case. Problem-solving cases focus on outcomes instead of process. So usually if we think about like the criminal trial, it's about the process and the rights and objection and opening statements and this comes first and that comes first and blah, 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 blah. But problem-solving courts focus on outcomes like, you know, abstinence from drugs or reduced recidivism or community safety or, you know, these kinds of outcomes, evaluating and monitoring them. Collaboration, this kind of goes along with what I mentioned about non-traditional roles, but, you know, non-adversarial courtroom players, and then partnerships with like mental health providers and service providers in the community. And then finally, problem-solving courts are supposed to be evidence-based or best practices. So relying upon things like, you know, validated screening instruments, risk assessments, evidence-based treatment plans, et cetera, to accomplish those outcomes. So, you know, to sum up, there's, you know, those are the characteristics of problem-solving courts. And particularly, there's lots of good research on drug courts.
Yes.
Other types of problem-solving courts are less studied. So all those others that I mentioned, we don't really know a lot about them and are less confident about their effectiveness. But let's look specifically at drug courts and the drug court model. So drug courts.
Let's do that.
Yeah,
let's do that.
Mm-hmm. So drug court started in Miami in the 1980s.
Cocaine.
When you say
Miami in the 80s, that's what I think of. It's Miami Vice and cocaine.
Yeah, I was trying to think of the rest of the words to Eric Clapton song, but all I know is the parody that I mentioned before.
Yeah.
Cocaine.
That's
so
it.
High. Anyway, yeah, something like that. But anyway, Miami drug courts focused on serving individuals convicted of a nonviolent offense who had a substance use disorder. And as I mentioned before, people, you know, volunteer to participate in exchange for diversion, reduction in their sentence, dismissal of charges in drug courts. You know, judge heavily supervises the process. Case managers are involved to kind of oversee the treatment. There's a system of graduated sanctions that's used to kind of ensure compliance with the program. So we mentioned graduated sanctions before, but kind of increasing punishments for failure to comply to assure accountability and showing up for treatment appointments, failing felon drug test, things like that. So those are kind of the basic features, but other than that, there's a lot of variation in drug court models and programs.
Okay, so how and why do they work?
Well, drug courts combine several theoretical mechanisms.
Okie dokie.
Yeah, we don't want to talk too much about theory, boo theory. you know, there are several ways that drug courts are kind of theorized to promote desistance, which is a criminological term for basically stopping your criminal career.
It's jargon, criminological jargon. Yeah.
Just stopping crime. So I mentioned the sanctions before. So number one, there's kind of the deterrence idea that these sanctions will provide accountability for violations. Number two, treatment and rehabilitation. So through evidence-based programs, rehabilitative interventions, the idea is to, you know, fix, treat the underlying problem, particularly the substance use disorder if we're talking about. Drug courts, and then number three is procedural justice. So I've mentioned kind of like the less adversarial, less punitive approach. So drug courts have more or higher levels of procedural justice. They treat participants with more dignity. They have more transparency. They're perceived as more fair. And there have been a number of studies, like, you know, two or three that I read while I was preparing this, that have kind of indicated that this is one of like the big keys to the success, like one of the causal pathways. Why drug courts are so successful.
Because they treat people like human beings.
They treat people like human beings. People who participate in drug courts feel like the judge treats them with respect, listens to their perspective, treats them with a dignity. And of course, that is a component of procedural justice.
Right.
So, you know, participants feel much more satisfied with the judge and, you know, the way that they're treated and the way that the judge interacts with them in drug courts.
Yeah.
And that's an important lesson, not just for drug courts, but for the system overall. We've talked about, you know, the procedural justice before, and that treating people fairly with dignity and respect is important for legitimacy and important for outcomes too, like, you know, recidivism. So,
So little spoiler alert for our book that will be coming out in terms of procedural justice. That a lack of procedural justice in some countries has been cited as increasing vigilantism.
Yeah, sure.
So stay tuned for when we have episodes devoted to
procedural justice and vigilantes book. For sure.
Yes.
Procedural justice, again, it is important for kind of like legitimacy or getting buy-in, people to kind of like buy in and cooperate and follow the rules and laws and stuff. And like I said, drug courts have been extensively researched. There are 100 plus studies of drug courts using like control groups or comparison groups, control group particularly kind of like the gold standard.
Right.
In social science research.
Yes.
The most well-known study on drug courts was commissioned by NIJ, National Institute of Justice, in 2003, the Multi-Site Adult Drug Court Evaluation. That's a mouthful.
Yeah. MADCE, MADC something is the acronym.
Multi-Site Adult Drug Court Evaluation. Okay. So basically, it was a study of 23 drug courts across six states with comparison court systems that examined a number of different outcomes at 6 and 18 months, including drug use, crime, and cost savings.
Okay.
So some of the key findings include that drug courts reduce substance abuse.
Okie dokie.
So participants in drug courts were significantly less likely, about 20% less likely, to report using any drugs and to report using hard drugs. And they were also about 20% less likely to test positive for drug use.
I mean, that may not seem like a lot to our listeners, but 20% of anything is a pretty significant reduction.
In social science. That's a pretty big difference.
Yeah.
And that difference was even larger for more frequent, serious, hard drug users. More on that later. We'll come back to that a bit later. Crime participants were 10 to 20% less likely to report committing another crime and were less likely to be arrested.
Now, that is significant because having a 20% recidivism rate, as reported by some countries, is, you know, considered pretty high.
Well, I mean, that's a 20% difference between treatment and comparison group.
Gotcha.
Essentially.
Oh, okay.
So it's not like 20% were rearrested.
Okay.
but you know, 20% reduction. But,
gotcha. Or thanks difference. For the clarification. Yeah.
No problem. I mean, we're going to be statistically precise.
We do. You know. We do.
There were modest improvements in social outcomes, things like employment, education, income, and family conflict. Not super strong, but there were some. And then cost savings. So, you know, they did like cost benefit analysis and drug courts.
Yeah.
Obviously, the process itself costs more than a typical trial.
Yes.
But the cost savings in the analyses came from the reductions in outcomes. So these, you know, reductions in recidivism and drug use save money for, you know, future victims, future arrest, trial processes, et cetera. So the estimated cost savings in this study was between $5,500 to $6,500 per participant.
Wow. Yeah.
That went through drug courts. So about every dollar spent on drug courts netted a $2 chuck return.
Well, if you only care about money, then having like a cost savings should be a reason to support these courts.
Well, and as we've seen, that's kind of the bottom line.
Yeah, sounds great.
Money is bottom line.
So what are some concerns with these courts?
Mm-hmm. Unlike you, me, and Mary Poppins,
yes,
who are practically perfect in every way,
yes,
there are some questions or some problems about drug courts, and even more broadly, problem-solving courts in general. So I mentioned this before, problem-solving courts. Other than drug courts, there's not a lot of research on,
right,
you know, like mental health courts and reentry courts and veterans courts. And a lot of times they're kind of started by the judge based on, you know, like the judge's ideology or observation, which,
yes,
may not be based on sound principles or maybe based on bad suppositions. So, mental health court, obviously, want to help people with mental health problems, but the stigma of mental health disorder and the link between mental health and crime is complicated.
Yeah, very complicated.
It's not as, simple as, you know, people with mental health problems commit crime. And a lot of people think that's the case.
Unfortunately.
We don't know a lot about problem-solving courts, and, you know, mental health is not a strong predictor of crime. So a lot of these problem-solving courts may be kind of based on bad ideology or supposition like that.
Gotcha.
Drug courts, as we've said, are popular and widespread, but may actually only serve a small portion of drug offenders.
Yeah.
So these programs, they're small, they're intense, they're highly restrictive.
Yeah.
You know, I mentioned before about like serious offenders being more serious drug users being more successful in drug courts. But a lot of times, and this is a broader problem in corrections and rehabilitation in general, that eligibility criteria of a lot of rehabilitation programs restrict like more serious offenders, more violent offenders.
Yeah.
Basically, the people that need help, need treatment, need rehabilitation the most oftentimes are disqualified from participating.
Yes.
And even broader than drug court, the literature shows that people, you know, like high-risk offenders, people who are at risk of repeating their crime, they're the ones who actually improve the most in rehabilitation.
So the criteria for getting into this creates like a selection bias already, because the people who are more likely to do better or... because some of the studies use controls, right?
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say it's kind of like a selection effect, because these are people with, still people with substance abuse problems. They're they're lower risk, and there are still differences between like treatment and control groups. But, you know, obviously the more problems that you have, the more help that you need.
Right.
And, you know, the better that treatment can be.
Yes, yes.
We kind of talked a little bit about the magnitude of like recidivism rates and drug use difference in studies. So sometimes that may be a bit overstated. Data indicates that about half of participants successfully complete programs.
Yeah.
And recidivism reductions are definitely there. And we talked about, you know, kind of like, oh, that's a lot. But, you know, as we mentioned with recidivism rates, they're pretty high in general. So if we're talking about like, you know, 50% compared to see, like 66% recidivism.
Yeah.
Drug courts don't like 100% fix all problems.
Yeah, because, imagine you got to deal with the root cause
of
substance use also.
Mm-hmm. And even if you are, you know, using evidence-based programs, addictions, it's not a simple problem to address.
No, none of these are simple problems that problem-solving courts are trying to solve.
Yeah, exactly. And then finally, problem-solving courts are popular with judges. A lot of times judges are the ones who kind of spearhead these initiatives. They feel like they're making a difference. And that in and itself isn't necessarily a bad thing. But one article I read, one legal scholar has argued that like these problem-solving courts are a way for judges to kind of regain some power that they've lost in the court system.
Because they have a more active role in the process.
Yeah, so, you know, we talked about plea bargaining.
Yes.
How essentially judges are kind of just like rubber stampers there. The real, you know, work is done with, you know, plea negotiations and judges just approve them.
Right.
And then I think we also mentioned how a lot of times like get tough legislation, mandatory minimums, three strike sentencing guidelines, all of those reduce judicial discretion, judicial power in sentencing. And in like a drug court, the judge is like the, you know, paternalistic overseer. They're kind of like in charge of everything. So it may be a way for them to kind of like get some power.
Here's another suggestion. They could leave and go move to a country and be a judge under the civil legal tradition where the judge is actually a part of the investigative process.
Well, that's interesting because in this article, it argued that maybe we shouldn't even call them problem-solving courts because judges are kind of more like administrators just overseeing the process as opposed to like ruling on evidence or making legal decisions, etc. But then on the other hand, this has kind of also led to the institutionalization of problem-solving courts.
Right.
So if you're a judge who started this and this is your baby, you kind of like, you know, get into your own habits and patterns. And I'm using air quotes here, like evidence-based practices.
Yeah.
You may be resistant to change and you've got your own like habits and rules and ways of doing things. So that can also be an issue.
Imagine this. Judges are people.
They are indeed. They are
and this indeed. Influences the process.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, right. Good things to consider.
Yeah, so problem-solving courts, they aren't perfect, but they're coming from a place of trying to do something different besides lock them up,
right?
Trying to help fix underlying problems. And drug courts do have lots of evidence and, you know, with the limitations that I mentioned just now, seem to be effective.
Yeah.
Anything else?
Have nothing.
No. Okay. Well, good. Let's wrap it up then with our Minute to Spin It, where we both give our takeaway from the episode today.
Problem-solving courts may solve some problems, but they don't solve all problems or even most.
Yeah.
That's it. That's all I have. Ben, what's your spin?
Well, as Mr. Mackey would say, drug courts teach people that drugs are buying. Okay. Don't do drugs. Drugs are buying. So you said, you know, your spin wasn't funny. I really struggled to come up with anything funny for like
It's hard
drugs or drug courts.
Courts. Yeah.
But I did see this meme that you would appreciate this morning. It was like a cat in the courtroom. It's like putting cats through drug courts for catnip.
So it was
like a real picture of like a cat up on a banister in a courtroom.
Very cute.
But anyway, problem solving courts, much better option than locking people away, throwing away the key, letting them sit in prison. And with more research and evidence-based practices, problem solving courts are a step in the right direction.
We are a community-driven podcast sponsored by the Gundy Center and produced by JMU Libraries. Check out our website linked in show notes to see how you can support our educational programming.